Welcome to the worst nightmare of all. Reality.
Okay, what we're thinking of as aliens are they're extra dimensional beings.
Explore the lesser-known stories of our unknown world. Join the pursuit of the paranormal with Ash and Greg.
So thank you for joining us in this episode where we will be talking about the Rendlesham Forest incident. Now, when I say Rendlesham Forest incident, you might be thinking of the events that took place over several nights in 1980. But that's not the Rendlesham Forest incident that we're going to be talking about today, are we, Ash?
No. So pretty much everyone knows about the Rendlesham Forest 1980 incident. So we don't want to spend too much time talking about that. What we're going to be talking about is the past events and incidents that happened in that area. But we're going to be going back years. I'm talking 800 years of paranormal history that happened around Rendlesham Forest. So you might think, why is that relevant to something that happened 40 years ago? But as we go on, and the more we talk about what's happened in the past, it should start to make sense that why we're telling you this, as it all builds up towards those three nights in 1980.
Cool. Sounds fascinating. And I know we've briefly spoke before the podcast about what this all this past information looks like, and it's going to be a really interesting listen. So, yeah, do you want to start us off, Ash?
Yeah, so I'll just briefly mention that if you don't know about the Rendlesham Forest incident, or you just need a bit of a refresher, there's tons of podcasts and YouTube videos and websites. Mm-hmm. So you want to look at that afterwards, that probably make a bit more sense. Listen to the podcast first and then go find out what happened, or refresh your memory about what happened, because it probably make a lot more sense if you do it that way. But for starters, we're going to go back to the 12th century, so the 1100s, for a case that became known as the Wild Man of Orford.
Okay, cool.
So this was first recorded in the year 1200, but the actual event happened a few years before. And what happened was that some fishermen fishing near Orford Ness caught what they described as a heavy, hairy, naked and bedraggled man, and they caught them in his fishing nets. And this was close to Orford Ness, and you might recognise the name Orford Ness, Greg.
Yeah, I think that's where the lighthouse is currently, or has been situated, which is part of the Rendlesham Forest 1980 incident as well. So yeah, that does ring a bell to me.
Yeah, the lighthouse was believed that the lights that were seen on the 1980 event were caused by the Orford Ness Lighthouse. Highly doubt that was the case, but that was a heavily used way to debunk those sightings. But the area of Orford Ness, there's been tons of secret experiments, military buildings, military testing that's gone on over there. But going back to this 12th century event, the Wild Man of Orford. So the fishermen caught this man in the nets in the water, and they actually imprisoned him at the Orford Castle. And they tortured him before one night he actually escaped, and they never saw him again. Because he came from the water, some people actually said he was a merman, a male mermaid, and some later written accounts actually said that he had webbed hands and feet.
Oh,
that's been the legend of him being a merman, and that when he escaped, he just went back to the water and was never seen again.
That's crazy. That is crazy. So are there any sort of artist impressions? Is there any sort of drawings about what this guy is supposed to have looked like?
Yeah, there is.
Yeah.
We'll stick them on social media. None of the drawings have him as having webbed feet, but it's more written accounts that said, from later accounts that say he had webbed feet or hands. So how true it is, we don't know. But none of the drawings depict that he had these webbed hands. But Wild Man, or Wild Men, have been seen quite a lot all around the UK. Here's another name for Bigfoot in some cases, but I don't think this was related to Bigfoot. It's just the name of him being a wild man, basically.
Okay. Yeah.
So now, the next case I'm going to mention is the Dunwich Atlantis. So the village of Dunwich is about 15 kilometres north of
Orford.
So again, we're not far from Rendlesham, we're in that general vicinity. And this is the coastal town of Dunwich, is actually known as Britain's Atlantis.
Okay, not heard of that.
So basically what's happened is it was a city that used to have around 4,000 population. And over the years it just became eroded by the ocean. Just falling away into the ocean. And now it's just a small coastal village. Most of it was eroded into the seas. You can actually see images of the underwater ruins that researchers have found. But it was at the end of the 1300s when there was ferocious storms battering the town and actually destroyed around 400 homes and two churches. So a lot of people were killed. That's when they lost a lot of the town into the ocean. And on stormy nights, you can still hear the frantic ringing of the church bells in the wind as the reliving the residents and the church pastors panicking and trying to help people on that night.
Oh, crazy. Yeah, I'd not heard of that at all. Certainly not any sort of weird bell ringing. That's going to be pretty freaky, I'd imagine.
So now we're going to head a couple of kilometres inland from Dunwich. And this is the village of Wesselton, home of what is known as Satan's Church.
That sounds interesting and slightly ominous.
There's a lot of ominous. So not only is it called Satan's Church because they believe that Satan himself lives there, they also have a witch that they believe resides at the church. So as well as the devil, you've got a witch. So it's quite a creepy church, this one.
Jesus Christ. Not Jesus Christ, that's the case.
Well, you might need Jesus Christ in this church. So they call it Satan's Church, and because since 1340, it's St. Peter's Church in Wesselton, and they've been plagued with bad luck. They've had the church spire has been destroyed a couple of times. First by high winds, like 300 years ago. Then the Germans bombed it during the Second World War and destroyed it again. Where the Satan bit comes in, that there's a grate next to the priest's door, a small grate in the floor, and that's where they believe that Satan lives, like just underneath the church, with the church crypt or whatever, it's underneath the church there. And the witch part of it, that's come into the story because there's a gravestone that's fell over from the 14th century, and it's level with the ground, but no grass or weeds have ever grown on the top of it, so it's just always been a clean gravestone.
Okay.
And so that's been known as the witch's gravestone in the churchyard. So we've got the devil living under the church and we've got the witch's gravestone. And so this is where sort of more myth comes into it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a ritual that apparently not many people are brave enough to try. But if you place a handkerchief or some other small item on top of the grating above where the devil lives, then you start on the witch's stone, run anti-clockwise around the church 7 times, and when you get back after the 7th time, the handkerchief or item disappears, and you can actually hear the chains of Satan rattling from beneath the churchyard.
What?
From beneath the church. And that's the ancient myth around this very creepy church with a number of scary residents.
Oh my God, that is... I've never heard of that. I've never heard that story. And as I say, I do paranormal interest, but that's something out of a horror film right there, isn't it?
Would you do it? Would you do the running around?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'd give anything to go like that. Before I started paranormal investigations, I used to be freaked out by like Ouija boards and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I'd quite happily sit in a dark room in a haunted castle on my own in total darkness and start talking to anybody and anything that might be there, and it doesn't bother me. But that's a whole nother level of weirdness.
Summoning the devil.
Yeah, that is. That's something
quite next level, I think.
That's next level. That is like the kind of stuff that you see in horror films, and you're just going, you know what? that's a bad idea.
And so he's shouting at him like, don't go in that room. Stop, just leave, just go home. Why?
Yeah, you'll be dead next. So yeah, that is a proper, that's next level weirdness. I like that one. For the road trip coming on, Ash.
Yeah, definitely. I'm up for that one. So far we've had witches, demons, underwater cities, wild men, and it wouldn't be complete without talking about demon dogs, or what is known as the Black Shuk demon dog. And these are, Black Shuk's one of the names, is Old Shuk. There's other names that people have used for years that basically describes a ghostly black dog that roams the coastline and countryside of the east of England, so the area of Suffolk and the old East Anglia. And it was in Blythburgh in 1577, very stormy night, when this demon dog, this Black Shuk, tore the throats of two of the members of the congregation in the local church. So ran into the church on this stormy night, tore the throats of two of the congregation. And as it howled and left the church, the spire collapsed and crashed through the roof of the church. And legend has it that if you go to the church today, you can still see the claw marks in the church door. And yeah, this demon dog got into the actual church.
Oh, definite road trip for us, Ash.
A lot round there.
We need to try and make sure we don't do it when it's a dark and stormy night, because it doesn't appear that nice things happen.
Yeah, that's a bit of a running theme.
Yeah. Okay, that's another one. Not heard of that either, so...
So that wraps up some of the older stuff we're going to be talking about, just some of the strange events linked to that area around Randlesham Forest.
Cool, that was interesting. But how does that link to the 1980 UFO event?
So the 1980 UFO incident isn't the only UFO incident to have taken place at Bentwaters. There's actually been a few UFO incidents over the years. In 1956, on the 13th of August, around 9:30 p.m, radar operators at the Bentwaters base tracked a group of targets moving slowly northeast, and these all merged into one very large object before this moved off to the north. And that was followed by a single light on radar, a single object on radar that just flew across the screen from east to west. They sent a plane to investigate these objects that they tracked on radar, and he found nothing, and nothing was seen from the ground or from anybody else. It was purely a radar tracking that saw these objects.
So that was over the base?
Over the base, yeah. So when the number of objects travelled over and then they merged into one big object,
yeah,
which is something like three times the size of a normal plane.
Okay.
So this is why they sent the planes out to intercept it. But they couldn't find anything, and no one on the ground saw anything. They're saying it could be possible radar malfunction or something that showing these objects. But 90 minutes later, they saw something again. And this time they saw another target approaching the base. This was travelling at an estimated 2,000 to 4,000 miles per hour towards the base.
Well,
and it directly travelled above the base because it disappeared from radar very briefly and then appeared again just further past.
So the way it disappeared, is that where it's gone over the top?
Yeah, there's a blind spot from the radar. Yeah, that's where it disappeared from the sighting. Like I say, it's travelling up to 4,000 miles per hour at this fast light, and the difference this time was it's actually seen by other people. So it saw from soldiers on the ground, and there's a pilot travelling at 4,000 feet reported seeing the same bright light actually beneath his aircraft. So he saw it flying beneath him.
Wow.
So obviously they got these number of reports, so they actually got in contact with RAF Lakenheath, which is 40 miles away from Bentwaters, to basically say, we've tracked these objects and they're coming sort of towards you. And again, officers at RAF Lakenheath saw the same thing, and they saw these bright objects. So they're watching it in the sky, and then they saw basically change direction very quickly.
Okay.
And then as they're moving away, they got smaller until they just disappeared.
That's crazy. And isn't it funny how when people see these lights in the sky and whatnot, they always perform these weird manoeuvres. So they do change direction really quickly.
Yeah, because there was actually a meteor shower that night. So people like looking to say these were meteors. Mm-hmm. It was the Perseids, I think. It was quite a heavy meteor-laden night. But these movements that they saw at Lakenheath, these weren't movements that meteors make or that other space objects make. They don't change direction. They don't. It sort of gets smaller.
Yeah, and I suppose... there's hardly any satellites up in the sky at that point either, like there is now.
Yeah, not like there is now.
No, so, and satellites don't change direction pretty well. They can move out of orbit, but they don't change direction, really.
Yeah, not like that, not at speed.
No.
Yeah, okay. That these lights were travelling. So the incident was actually part of the original Project Blue Book investigations that were carried out by the US Air Force in the 50s. And when the Condon Committee, the Condon Committee was put together to basically look at all the files that the Project Blue Book and other civil organisations had put together of UFO sightings, UFO reports, and the Condon Committee basically to examine these files and decide whether there's anything worth continuing to investigate it and if there's any threat to the US or wherever. And the Condon Committee found, and I quote, "In conclusion, although conventional or natural explanations certainly cannot be ruled out, the probability of such seems low in this case. And the probability that at least one genuine UFO was involved appears to be fairly high." And that's what the final report said into this UFO incident.
That's mad. That's similar type wording to stuff that's coming out nowadays or recently about the UAPs. So yeah, that's big news. That's big. So that was the 1956 UFO incident at the Benton Waters base. We'll now jump forward a couple of decades to 1980. But again, we're still not talking about the famous December 1980 UFO incident.
No, we're actually going to go to February 1980 for this one. And this is Lori Rehfeldt's UFO sighting. She was an American airman stationed at RAF Benton Waters between 1978 and 1980. She was working with the Air Force Police with the 81st Security Police Squadron. And she worked between both the bases, Benton Waters and Woodbridge. And it was in February 1980, like I said. She and her colleague Keith Duffield, they were on patrol about 3 o'clock in the morning. And they went to check these gates was locked. Just doing the rounds, making sure everywhere's safe. Because they were responsible for doing the patrols, policing the actual staff on the site, and doing all vehicle checks and stuff like this.
Yep.
So it was 3 o'clock in the morning there, around the East Gate, and they saw what they thought were aircraft lights just approaching the airbase, which is quite usual. They would have cargo deliveries and stuff, and they started thinking, oh, we'll have to get the customs forms ready for whatever's coming in. And so they waited by the East Gate in the van, waiting for this aircraft to land, when all of a sudden it just stopped, and this light was just hovering. She said it was like it had been caught on camera, it just suddenly stopped moving. About 100 yards away from the runway and a couple hundred feet in the air, so it's quite close. And the path it came in on was similar to what aircraft were coming in. It's coming in from the North Sea. And they waited for the runway lights to be turned on, and they just didn't get turned on. And then, like I say, the light just stopped and was just hovering. And then all of a sudden, it started moving, like up and down, left and right, sort of like making a cross shape in the sky. So they just stood, both of them just stood watching it, and all of a sudden it just like burst into 3 different pieces, and it flew across the runway at immense speed right in front of them across the runway, and then just shut up and disappeared. So they both just sat in the truck just like, what the hell is this? And they just sat watching the sky, just like waiting for it to come back. When it didn't come back, it just disappeared. So she says to Keith, a colleague, like, call it in. And he's a bit hesitant. He's like, no. He's like, you call it in, you're the senior officer. So she was a bit hesitant to do it because, one, it's a UFO and they don't want to be reporting these types of things. And also, Laurie, she wasn't the most well-liked airman on the base. She had a bit, people had a bit of a problem with her being quite outspoken. And she's like a young female like airman at the time. But she had to do her job, so she called the desk sergeant, told him what they just saw. And he told them to go to the control tower and see if they saw anything. So they drove to the air control tower, knocked on the door. And when the guy answered, the officer in the control tower, he said he looked like he'd just woken him up. Like his appearance was like he'd just woken up. So he opens the door, lets him into the control tower. And she's like, did you just see these lights going across the runway? And he was like, no, I didn't see anything. Like trying to cover up that he was asleep.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And he was like, could have been afterburners from one of the British planes, from one of the nearby bases. There's quite a few around there. And she was like, no, I know what afterburners like, and it made no noise whatsoever. It's just completely silent. So only them two saw it. It wasn't on, well, the radar operators and the control tower didn't see anything. Possibly asleep.
Yeah.
And that was it. That was nothing really came off it. She got a bit of teasing over the next few weeks. She became known as Lois or UFO and all that sort of stuff on the base. And then she actually left in mid-December 1980. So she left like 2 weeks before the famous incident. Wow. And she didn't know anything about it. She was, I think it was in the mid-90s. She was just like Googling Bentwaters and then all the UFO stuff came up. And she's like, oh, they've come back. They must have come back. And so she didn't even hear anything about it until 15 years later.
That's crazy. Yeah, because I live near a base and I've seen planes come in and then shoot off with their afterburners and they have some loud, loud sounds. Yeah, if that was only a matter of 100 or so feet away, you'd definitely know about it. It's a shame that nothing was captured on Control Tower.
Yeah, he was asleep, apparently.
Yeah.
Which can you sort of not too unrealistic, it might.
No, honestly, if you're not expecting any planes in, then yeah, you quite possibly would rest your eyes for a little bit, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, there is some missing time aspect to it as well, because she only realised sort of like say afterwards, because she knows she was at the gate doing the checks at like 3 a.m. when they went to Control Tower. She said it was just becoming sunlight, like over the North Sea, over to the east. But that wouldn't have been, it shouldn't have been like that at 3 a.m. in the middle of winter. This is February.
Yeah, so February.
It won't start getting light until more like mid-morning.
I was going to say, yeah, you're looking 7 o'clock-ish, aren't you? Yeah,
right. But that's something she didn't realise until like years later, that it shouldn't have been daylight. So there's possibly some aspect of missing time.
Yeah, I never even heard of this incident either before now. So... yeah, that is kind of a weird one as well. And like you say, they would be used to seeing things in the sky, normal stuff. You'd like to think they would know the difference between what they're seeing and what they know to be in the sky. So, yeah.
Like I say, she thought it was just an aircraft because the approach it was taking just looked just like it would take the usual approach that the planes do. Mm-hmm. And they were just waiting for the runway lights to turn on, and they just never did. And then they just... stopped and then all of a sudden flew across the runway at speed. Obviously she could say, because this is like, it's coming to the base pretty much, it's encroached obviously in their airspace, and that was it, and nothing really happened from it.
And I suppose if there's no sort of record of it anywhere, then it's unlikely that it would there'd be anything other than just their sort of account of what happened.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, now I just want to talk about the scientific and military developments that took place in the area around Mendelssohn Forest, both before and after the Second World War. Not all of these are public knowledge, and some are still shrouded in mystery. For most of the 20th century, Orphan Ness itself has actually been owned by the Ministry of Defence, or the War Department as it used to be. And they took it over in 1913, and much of the Ness was drained of water so they could build airfields. It was the Central Flying School. They had what's called the Experimental Flying Section. And they tested aircrafts, machine guns, bombs, night sights. And they were just testing all this stuff in Orphan Ness, obviously in the run-up to the First World War. It was also a prisoner of war camp during the First World War, and they had German and Chinese personnel held there, and they used them to actually construct the flood defences around like, the East Coast. But after the war, in the 1920s, it was just used as a fire and a bombing range by the Aeroplane and Armaments Experimental Establishment. So it's, again, it's just basically a military testing range since 1913. But then we head to 1935. The first ever purpose-built radar masts were built here. And these actually led to the development of the radars, which were crucial in the Battle of Britain. And ultimately, the success of the Second World War. So it's possible that these radars that were developed at Orphan Ness helped us win the Second World War due to all the advances in technology they did.
So do we know if those radars, has there been any confirmation that they've picked up anything during sort of those early years of testing?
No, I'm not meant to find anything.
No.
I think they're too busy concentrating on the Second World War, I think, at the time.
Yeah, that's probably quite an important thing to focus on.
Yeah, but before that, they actually had been discussed whether they could actually use radio waves to shoot down enemy planes.
Okay.
Like a, sort of like a death ray. But that was quickly quashed, and nothing more came out of that. But it was discussed, definitely.
Okay, because that's still an avenue. I know that they're trying to be able to shoot down planes with lasers and all that kind of stuff. So it's probably still quite high up on their list, I suspect.
Yeah, definitely a good. Well, I suppose it'd be good technology to more like James Bond type of technology. But from after the Second World War, so now we're talking from 1953 to 1966. They were testing atomic weapons there. So what they used it for was to mimic the environmental pressures that the weapons actually have when they're deployed. So they had these big underground pits where they would simulate the rigors that the bomb would go through as it's being deployed. And they built the buildings that you can actually, because the National Trust own it now, you can actually go into the little pillboxes.
Okay.
That they used to view the atomic testing from. You can actually go and visit and have a look at them.
Sounds like a road trip.
Definitely, we can add it to the air, the Suffolk, to the Suffolk road trip. But in the late 60s to the early 70s, the United States moved in with the experimental and top secret Cobra Mist radar system that was stationed at Orphan Ness.
Okay.
This was an experimental, and like I say, top secret. It was over the horizon radar, so they could see basically whole of Europe and Eastern Europe on these radars. They originally wanted it in Turkey, but Turkey were like, no, you're not having it here. So they came to Orphan Ness. But that for when they launched it, and they just had loads of problems with it, there was just lots of like interference that they just couldn't explain. So it only lasted a couple of years before they binned it and just couldn't find out why they're having problems, so they just got rid of it. And then it remained military, like I say, until 1993, when the MOD sold it to the National Trust, and they've had it ever since.
Cool. And you can go and walk around the Rendlesham Forest area as well, can't you? I think there is a trail and all that kind of stuff. So
yeah, there's a UFO trail. It's actually got like a model UFO of what they saw on the trail. Apparently it's not where it was seen.
Okay.
It's in a different part of the forest. I mean, that's on the side. They've got a UFO trail. Where they say UFO, where the like Jim Bennison touched it.
Yeah.
That's in a different part of the forest.
Okay.
But actually, I've not been, but that's definitely on the bucket list for 2021.
Yeah, definitely.
As we can see, there's a huge history of military work and secret experiments and secret projects that all have gone on literally around that bit of area in Suffolk. But I just want to quickly go back to Second World War, because at the mouth of Orphan Ness is a little hamlet called Shingle Street, and this place during the Second World War, it had been evacuated of citizens. There were rumours of failed German invasions all up and down the east coast during the Second World War. Although the government actually released some documents in 1993, we weren't supposed to release it until, I think it was either this year or next year. But they released them in 1993 because they had lots of pressure to release these documents. And none of these actually have details of any German failed invasions. But during the Second World War, these rumours of failed invasions were quite common. So it helped boost the morale of the people and the soldiers. Thinking that, oh, Germans are coming, but we're keeping them out, basically. And it also helped build relations with America. So we were saying, they were hearing these rumours that we were fighting off the Germans. So that gave them more onus to come and help us. But it's one of these German invasions, these rumoured German invasions that I want to talk about. This took place in Shingle Street. And that there's some strange events that happened that are still talked about today. Some 70 years later, like we are on this podcast. So this story comes from a guy whose father served in the Home Guard during the Second World War, and it was in autumn of 1940 they were sent to Colchester Barracks in Essex. Then they were transferred from there to an unknown location. All the while they were driving to the location, they were told not to look out the back of the truck, because you can't know where you're going. And as they'd been driving for quite a long time, And at one point, this guy's dad, he actually looked out the back of the truck and he saw, like, the sky was orange and he saw basically the sea on fire. So he thought it was like a downed tanker, right, and the petrol was ablaze. That was in the ocean. But during that time as well, they were actually trying to use that as a weapon, like, to see if they could actually set the sea on fire, to, as a way of stopping, like, invading armies coming through.
So he looked out the back and saw that the sea was on fire.
Yeah.
How big an area are we talking? Do we know? Or we don't know that, I suppose.
I don't know how big, but he said, like, the sky was orange, like, the sky was lit up by it.
Jesus.
And it just looked like the sea was on fire. So he thought it was, like, a tanker that had, like, obviously started going on fire or whatever. So they get to the location, which was later found out to be Single Street. And the shore was just awash with burned bodies, all wearing full German uniform. As far as you could see, there was just bodies. These dead Germans just burnt, basically. And they had to guard these bodies until the regular army came, and they took over, and then they got sent back. And they were told to never talk about where they went or what they saw.
That's absolutely weird as hell.
Like, and like this hamlet is like empty pretty much. So no, like, not like there's a army defence there that had obviously been defended against the Germans. There was just no one in this village.
And loads of dead Germans.
Just loads of dead German bodies. And they waited for the army to come and relieve them until they got sent back. And this story was apparently corroborated some years later by the creator of the Secret Army Museum. That's at Parham Airfield, which isn't too far from Shingle Street. And he said that the Dutch resistance, they filled up their hospitals with burnt German soldiers. And this was at the same time as this Shingle Street incident. So there's some corroboration there. But again, there's no evidence to prove any of this. It's only stories and rumours. Of course, there have been so many different rumours of disinformation, some propaganda. No one really knows it. It's just different stories from different times mixed up as we look back. But this the guy whose father told this story, he didn't tell him till like 40 years later, because he was told not to tell anybody. So he didn't for 40 years until he told his son, like, what had happened. So it's strange. But if it did happen, what happened?
Because you could say, kind of understand it, if it was a busy area and there was something of value to the Germans for them to really be there. But if it was a quiet hamlet with nobody living there, why would they? Well, I suppose that would be a good landing point. But do they know how many, roughly how many bodies? Or
just, no, I just said it's just a wash. That's all I could see, was just these bodies of
dead Germans
and then German, obviously Nazi uniforms.
That's strange.
So if it is true, if this did happen, this likely, well, suppose one of the only explanations is some weapon that they had developed, possibly at Orphan Ness. This is literally at the mouth of Orphan Ness, this hamlet, and they were using it on the Germans to either defend or test it out. Or
so I suppose it is possible that all those dead bodies could have been captured Germans and they were just testing on them, I suppose, rather than possibly an invasion. Yeah,
it could have been.
Wow, that's just really weird. But yeah, interesting that it's the location of all of this happening.
It's all centred around this region. And, and like I said at the start of the podcast, this is why I want to talk about what happened in the past. Because when we get on to the alternative explanation for what happened in the 1980 Rendlesham incident, these all tie in with that and then give a bit of a better understanding of the history and what has happened there in the past could explain what happened there in 1980.
Yeah, because I'm quite shocked at how much that we've been through on the podcast that I didn't know any of it. So to hear that there's so much.
Like, we could literally talk for days about the stuff. Obviously, we need to condense it and just briefly talk on each thing. But yeah,
wild man, this demon dog, all these military experiments,
number of UFO sightings on the same base
by separate people,
all different years.
Yeah, it definitely sort of makes you think about what happened. The official story.
Well, now we're actually talking about secret experiments, and in particular experiments conducted on soldiers and other military members. There's been theories bandied about for a few years, not least by Nick Redfern. Nick Redfern's an author, he's written quite a few books. He's a bit of a Marmite character. Some people like his stuff, some people think he's bonkers, basically, with some of his theories. And one of his theories, in one of his recent books, the book's called The Rendlesham Conspiracy, and he lays forward the claim that what happened in December 1980 was the result of a secret experiment using holograms and mind-altering drugs. And that's what the whole three-night incident came down to, was these drugs and holograms being used on the soldiers, on the airmen.
Well, it's certainly a theory, I suppose.
Definitely a theory, but it wouldn't be the first time. We all know about Porton Down,
yep.
The secret research facility in Wiltshire. And since the 1950s, they've been carrying out experiments similar to this on serving soldiers and serving Marines. There's one in the 1950s where they told soldiers that they were trying experiments to find a cure for the common cold. What they were actually doing was trying to see if they could use LSD as a truth serum. So these soldiers volunteered to try and do this testing for the common cold, when actually they're being guinea pigs for this LSD.
Well,
for this LSD experiment.
So they were willing participants in a drug trial, but not the drug trial that they thought they were being.
Yeah, and these doses they're giving them, because they're giving them LSD a couple of times a week.
Yeah.
To see how they react to it, and basically,
wildly, I imagine.
Yes, a lot of it was hallucinations. Create a lot of quite anxiety creating effects.
Yeah,
and some of them had flashbacks that years later, decades later, they're still having flashbacks to what they saw while they were on these hallucinatory drugs. And the MOD actually paid compensation some decades later, so they never admitted liability, but they did pay out to soldiers, which says it all, really.
That does. If that doesn't say I'm guilty, I don't know what.
Yeah. And this continued throughout the 60s, but the emphasis switched from the possibility of using it as a truth serum to a means of actually incapacitating the enemy. That's using it as a weapon, in chemical warfare, basically.
Yeah.
And it's in 1964 when 17 Royal Marine Commandos, they were taken to the woods. Again, this is voluntarily, they were told they were going to be part of an experiment, and they were given doses of LSD while they were in the woods. And there's a video you can see, it's black and white video. We basically see these 17 Marines, and they basically just lose control of their bodies and the mind. And there's one climbing the tree trying to feed the birds. You've got the troop commander just unable to control his laughing. Others are just walking around staggering and walking into trees and stuff, just giggling and laughing. So they couldn't do the job, basically, they were given this LSD. So that's why the government were trying to see if they could use it as a weapon.
Yes.
Spray the enemy with all this LSD and stop him being able to function, basically.
It's incredible. Yeah.
And these lasted for hours, these effects. So it's not too unrealistic to think that in the 1980s, in the middle of the Cold War, they got a big threat from Russia. Could they have still been using this as a possibility as a weapon?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they would try anything, especially something like that, that they know now that does work and will work for hours. Why not?
The main point that Nick Redfern makes about this is that the forest was filled with this gas of LSD. Mm-hmm. So when the airmen went to investigate these lights in the forest, they were hit by this dose of LSD or other type of drug that's obviously causing to hallucinate, see things in the forest that weren't there, and led to all the strange things that happened over the next few nights. And that the UFOs that they saw were holograms, which is, again, that's another thing that's been talked about quite a lot, is government has this hologram technology that they can use to project all sorts into the sky and make it look real. That's what when it comes to the 5G, and some people think that this 5G is going to cause holograms, that it's going to be a fake alien invasion that's coming, and that Yeah, it comes back to this. There's going to be a trial to see if they could convince US airmen that there's UFOs or craft in the sky. They could use that against the population itself.
That's some big claim. That is some big claim. I'm not so sure, but who knows? Who knows?
It's quite a dangerous experiment. So obviously these are active bases, active nuclear bases. We've obviously armed soldiers going into the woods. So with the ones in the past, they knew they were an experiment, not going to be given. I'm assuming they wouldn't have had live ammo with them during these experiments, but these soldiers would have, these airmen would have had.
Yeah, and I mean the tape recording from Charles Holt, he sounds to me extremely sort of in a heightened state of awareness, but he doesn't sound like he's on drugs, or he actually sounds like they're having
he's in control, a focused
conversation. Because he talks into the voice recorder and he's explaining what they're seeing, and it doesn't sound like I would have thought somebody would sound like if they didn't really know what was going on. I think there would be a bit more panic in his voice, although he is quite panicky, he's quite controlled. So I don't know, who knows with what the government's prepared to try.
That's a good point, and it comes back to when you ask the question of why, or why there, because there's such a history of strange things going on in that area for years. There's obviously the UFO sightings in the past at the base itself, got all these strange paranormal things going on, strange creatures and folklore and myths going back hundreds of years. It would be a good place to do an experiment like that, because it can be passed off as shit like that happens in that area.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if it was in, I don't know, somewhere that's quite a controlled base, it's quite random. But when you think about the history of that area, it kind of think, oh, it's Randlesham, there's all sorts going on there.
Yeah.
That sort of muddies the water a bit for if it is the government doing these tests, experiments. The water's already muddied.
Yeah, and all the stuff that we've covered off that's happened over the last sort of 800 years, it's definitely is a weird area. So, yeah, you could see why it wouldn't look out of place, all this weird stuff happening in that particular area. So when you put all the pieces together, like you've mentioned, it doesn't actually seem that weird that something like that has actually happened there.
So it would be a good place as any to actually do something like that if it was going to be an experiment. But one other theory that's put forward, a few people do like this theory, is that it was actually the SAS playing a prank on the US airmen.
Tell me more.
Because the SAS was said to have regularly tested US security by probing the perimeters of the Woodbridge and Bentwaters, kind of test how good their security is. Because they had nuclear warheads stored at the base, and obviously they needed to be making sure that this place is properly protected. What happened was, in August 1980, so this is just a few months before this event, an SAS troop parachuted into the complex. And they didn't know that the guards at the base had actually upgraded the systems. So they obviously found out that they'd parachuted into the base, and then they claimed that they were beaten up by the US airmen and like interrogated because they basically parachuted into the base. For 18 hours they're apparently held before the British authorities like intervened and told them to let them go. This theory is that they're getting them back for that. So they're playing this prank on him in the woods in the middle of the night over Christmas, as a way of getting back at him for when they captured him, so to speak, a few months earlier on one of their testing experiments.
Well, again, that's a good theory, but I still think it's all a bit, from going back to that voice recording from Charles Holt, that just sounds so genuine to me, that he's had a genuine experience that he truly believes happened, for something that he can't explain. And the way you can hear the guys in the background, you can hear them sort of like talking in the distance about what they're seeing. you'd think they'd spot a prank as well. Although, I don't think it would be that elaborate. I don't know.
Over 3 nights as well, it'd be quite...
quite a mission to pull off. And I know the SAS are good, but are they that good? I don't know. But it does, like you say, it's over 3 nights, and these are highly trained military personnel that have clearly seen something or multiple things over multiple nights.
Yeah, and I think it's a good job we have that recording, because I think that is, without that recording, I think there'd be a lot less to actually, I guess, that we would have been able to. Obviously, got the memo which first leaked, which led to the whole thing being out in the open anyway, which is 1983. But the recording just adds so much weight to something happened.
Yeah, aside from having any video that we know of, that voice recording is almost, it's definite proof that something happened and they experienced something.
Yeah, everything else is hearsay, pretty much.
Yeah,
like the Jim Peniston, was decades later when he remembered these binary codes and stuff that he'd written down in the notebook. So it's years and years later, and it's all, that's all hearsay, that's all. This happened. Some people back people, some people say that didn't happen, some people say this did happen. But what we do have is the recording, and that is proof enough that something happened.
Yeah, definitely
something was taken happened at the time, which is obviously the best time to have any evidences from when it happened.
Yeah, whilst it was happening, that's the one sort of piece of evidence that I've seen on loads of UFO stuff that is so compelling that when you listen to it, you get a feeling of being there.
Yeah.
Not that I would want to, based on what they cut describing, but I don't know if it would be an hallucination or something that somebody else has sort of done as a prank. It just seems, but when you listen to that voice recording, that it's just so compelling that they've experienced something that they've never seen before. But
yeah, definitely.
I don't know. So that about wraps up the last 800 years of strange and unusual events that have taken place in the Rendlesham area. I hope you've enjoyed our alternative look at the events leading up to the 3-night occurrence in 1980. Thank you for listening to this episode, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did, and hope you have a happy new year, whatever that may bring for you.
Pursuit of the Paranormal with Ash and Greg.